The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
Flypod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Today we have the New York Times bestseller Tess Gerritsen in. She's got a brand new book in the Rosalian Isles series, Last to Die in Rosalian Isles. You might have also heard of them. They have a fantastic hit on TNT. Tess, welcome.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be back.
All right, now, tell me a little bit about Rosalian Isles. How different are the characters on television as opposed to in your books?
There are some major differences. In the books, Jane Rosalie is an ordinary-looking woman who's a little bitter because men never notice her. And now she's played by Angie Harmon, who could not be go unnoticed in any imagination. Maura Isles, who is dark and goth and very disturbed in the books, is now quite a bit sunnier and funnier, and played by Sasha Alexander. What they were working with was the chemistry between two women and the sense of friendship between professionals.
Tess, I guess we'll look at the television series a little later, but let's talk about Last to Die, the brand new book in this series. Quite a few murders going on, right, in the first chapters.
Yeah, in a nutshell, it focuses on three young teenagers. 2 years before the book opens, all of them are survivors when their parents are massacred. And these three kids don't know each other. They're living in different countries. Now they're living in their foster families' homes, and the foster families get killed. Again, these three kids are the only ones who survive. What links them together? They don't know each other. And that's what Jane and Maura have to figure out. What is it that ties together Claire and Will and Teddy? Is it something in their past?
With a series, it's always good to start with the very first book, so you really don't get lost, and it's not too cloudy when you're reading these. What book is this in the series?
This is number 10, the first book in the series, which introduces Jane Rosalie as a minor character, was The Surgeon.
All right, so with The Surgeon, did you hear from fans saying, oh gosh, I love this character, we want her to come back? Or was it you that said, you know what, I think I'll put her with... Another character.
It was really a character that told me to do this. I introduced this really scary guy named Warren Hoyt, who at the end of The Surgeon is in jail, and I was done with him. But you know what? He kept talking to me. He kept saying, I'm not finished yet. Don't you want to hear what I'm going to do next? So I wrote the second book in the series because Warren kept insisting on it. But I also wanted to go back and explore Jane Rosalie, who was introduced as she came in. She was supposed to die in that first book. I thought I was going to kill her because she wasn't very likable. But by the end of writing The Surgeon, I knew her, and I was more curious about who she was going to be, how she was going to evolve. And that's how I ended up with a series, because it's the characters who demanded it.
I think with The Surgeon, wasn't there a kidnapping, the person portraying the surgeon kidnapped somebody?
In
a van?
Yeah. Oh, no, that was the second book.
That was the second book.
Okay. Yes. That was The Apprentice. When Warren and Jane have a rematch, they come heads to heads again, and that pretty much puts Warren away for good.
All right, Last to Die, of course. Now, we have these murders, we have these kids, different families, foster kids living in different families.
Yes.
For the most part. Okay. So how did you come up with the idea for Last to Die? I mean, you've got to come up with brand new ideas each time.
Yeah. It's always the idea that really gets me excited. I'm just always waiting for that real visceral moment when I think, oh, this is my story. Last to Die was inspired by two different elements. Number one is, I used to work as a doctor in a rehab hospital, and we, on the fourth floor, we had these head injury patients, who were segregated from the rest of the population because they had unusual, behaviors. They had a messed up sleep-wake cycle, and they were very impulsive. They could run across the street without thinking and hurt themselves. And I thought, what if I put those characteristics into a 13-year-old girl? You know, 13-year-olds already have teenage brain, and that's bad enough. But then if she's head injured because she had a bullet wound 2 years before when somebody tried to kill her, now she is not only a teenager, she also wanders at night, she also does impulsive things, but she still is of normal intelligence. And that is the character of Claire Ward. So I really had very clearly this image of this girl in my head, and I wanted to put her in a story. The other element that really gave birth to Last to Die was my interest when I was a kid of being a detective. Now, I was 10 years old. I had read a lot of Nancy Drew, and I thought I could be a detective. And I think this is a universal fantasy among children, that they can do things that adults don't give them credit for. So I wanted to write a story about teenage detectives, kids who are important to solving the crime. And in fact, I do have a sort of a trio of detectives who help Jane Rizzoli figure out what is going on here.
You were doing research for the Rizzoli and Isle series. I mean, detectives, a medical person there also. Mm-hmm. The medical issues you pretty much know because you're in that field. How about the detective work? How much research did you have to do, maybe from the very first book, and how is that carried over to this one?
Yeah, for the surgeon I did, I went down to Boston PD, and I met some of the homicide detectives there. What I came away with was not only that, you know, they had 12 detectives in their unit, and only one was a woman. When I went back there to visit a couple years later, that woman had quit. So it gave me a good idea of how stressful it is for a woman to be, you know, in a homicide unit. But I also wanted to get just a sense of what makes a cop, what makes a female cop. You know, how hard is it for them? And I think I got the feeling that most of them are pretty tough cookies. They have to be to make it in a man's field.
So what makes a foster kid? A lot of times, I think, not from personal experience or anything, but I think that a lot of them do run away, or they want to run away.
Well, these three kids are really looking for a safe harbor because they're very traumatized by the deaths of their families. And I wanted to get this sense that something continues to pursue them, you know, even after their families are dead. All, you know, they are the ones who are really in the sights of this killer. And it must be a really terrifying thing to think there is no safe place, which is why I created a special boarding school in this book called the Evensong School, which is specifically designed for kids just like them, children who have suffered some terrible crime, who are survivors. They come to Evensong to heal, but they also come to get the tools to fight back. And imagine a kind of a high school where you go to physics class, and not only do you learn E equals MC squared, you learn the physics of blood splatters. Or you go to botany class, and you learn to identify the most poisonous plants in the world. These children are being given the knowledge to become crime fighters, to give them some proactive way of reacting to what happened to them. And these are extraordinary children. And for me, that was the fun part, is creating this kind of a boarding school that I think would have been fun to attend. And I think a lot of kids would enjoy going to, you know, to take classes in CSI when they're still a very tender age.
Evensong, very descriptive. I mean, it comes alive. It's like you're there. You've got doors that are kind of hidden that you go into, maybe a huge library. It's a castle. Parts of it, you know, the older part is, you know, it'd be fantastic to live in the summer. Of course, their high-profile guests get to live in those rooms. Yeah. But in the winter, it's unlivable.
It's Maine. You know, and I live in Maine, so I know how cold it is, especially where I've set this particular school in the wilderness and in the woods. The funny thing about Maine is that we do have a number of Gothic kind of buildings that were built in the 1800s, largely by very, very rich people who would summer in Maine and who had traveled in Europe and who wanted to reproduce that sense of you know, Gothic architecture that they had seen when they were traveling. So it's not too far-fetched to think that, yes, an old railroad baron's castle might be converted to a school.
Yeah, it'd be a kind of a cool place to be. I mean, but, you know, for a kid, no cell phones or anything, but these kids, I mean, they make their own way, especially with all the books and their intelligence.
And their intelligence, and they are nurtured in ways that maybe your normal high school student wouldn't be, because it's a small student body, but a very devoted faculty.
And last, did I, you know, I'm kind of sad about one of the little boys. He not only lost his parents in this book, or yeah, in this book starting here, but he lost his parents also before that, another set of parents. Is that correct?
Yes, yes.
Who is that, and how does all that happen?
Well, there are three kids who are sort of fit that category, but the one that you're probably referring to is Teddy Kluck. He's a boy who his family was attacked when they were on a sailboat off St. Thomas. Everybody aboard was killed, and Teddy managed to survive because his father put him in a life jacket, and he doesn't remember because the boat exploded. But all he knows is that he woke up floating in the ocean, the only one still surviving. So Teddy is now living with a fairly wealthy family in Boston. He's their foster child. And in the middle of the night, somebody invades that house and kills the family. And Teddy survives by hiding under his bed. And so this is the terrified 14-year-old boy whom Jane encounters when she comes in on the case. It is in the city of Boston. She doesn't know about these other two children yet. She just knows she has a kid who's barely able to talk, who's so terrified that, you know, he won't even get out of this little huddled ball that he's in. And because she's the only woman detective, they assign her mommy duty to try and talk Teddy and get the information out of him.
And there, you know, when they're at the crime scene, they see the blood and they see these little footsteps, and they knew somebody walked through the blood, which was Teddy.
Yes.
And, you know, your book seems so descriptive. It's almost like reading, and you can see it in your mind's eye. How do you make things come alive like that?
I do see them in my mind's eye, and maybe it comes from my childhood of watching a lot of horror films. You know, that is really where I probably came to my conclusion that the height of entertainment is to scare my audience. My mom took me to lots of horror films when I was growing up, and I spent my childhood terrified in movie theaters, but really, really loving the American horror film.
So what was the most scary show that you ever saw that your mom took you to?
Well, you know, it's funny because you probably would not think it's that scary, but psychologically it was almost damaging to be taken to the original black and white version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I don't recall much violence in that book or much bloodshed, but what it was a metaphor for, I guess, alienation. It was, you know, you would wake up one day and the person you loved, the person you thought you knew, is suddenly not that person. They're a pod person, but you don't realize it. And, you know, I think that the scariest thing for a child is for mommy not to be mommy anymore, for the child to understand that, but nobody believes her. So I, you know, for many, many months as a child, I kept dreaming about pod people and being terrified of these things coming down from outer space.
Afraid to go outside at night, I guess.
Yeah, afraid to have the people you love change.
Back during the black and white movies, back a ways, probably 50s, 60s, maybe some 70s, although I think they started to get gorier in the 70s.
Yeah.
They really didn't show as much, but they seemed to be scarier. Am I correct on that, or
that's
was it
how
just
I feel.
Maybe
I,
the age?
Yeah, I think now they go for shock. They go for visual shock, and when you don't have that blood, that bright red splatter on the screen, and you're just seeing black and white, you have to fall back on good dialogue and good story. And that's what I miss about about Hollywood horror films. I mean, I don't really want to see guts all over the place. I want to be chilled to the bone by things that are actually happening or things that people are saying.
And with Rizzoli and Isles, I mean, sometimes you might look over your shoulder, especially in maybe that almost empty parking lot or late at night. Let's talk a little bit about the television show, how that came to be. I mean, I'm sure they bought the rights to your characters. Did
Yes.
you have much to do with anything else in that?
Yeah, you know, a couple years ago, I got a call from a TV producer, and he said, "I love your girls, and I think they belong on TV." And I didn't really think too much of it because I had sold or optioned most of my work to Hollywood, and nothing ever happened. It always fell apart, or they went away, and it all disappeared. So, I cashed the option check and forgot about it. And a year later, he comes back to me and he says, "I've hired a screenwriter. She's written a terrific pilot episode based on The Apprentice, and we're going to be taking it around and trying to cast it." And I still thought, not going to happen. You know, nothing's going to happen. And then they called and said, we cast the part of Jane Rosoli. And that's when I knew this was different. I'd never had anything come this close. They cast Angie Harmon. Gorgeous. They cast Sasha Alexander against her. They shot the pilot episode. I flew out to watch it because I figured this will be my only chance on a TV set. And it was picked up for a series and debuted to some of the highest numbers ever. So now it's going into its fourth season. One lesson I got out of that was, you know, he didn't say, I love your stories. He said, I love your characters. And that is what makes a good TV series, that these are people they can build on, they can develop. And in fact, a lot of the show, even though there is a crime every week, what it's really focused on is the relationship between Jane and Maura, the fact that they are really capable professionals and have become good friends and will even, you know, risk their lives for each other. This is something that we haven't seen in a long time on TV, maybe since Cagney and Lacey or Xena and Gabrielle. I mean, you know, the female buddy show where you have women in heroic roles and where men are just, you know, part of the landscape. It's unusual.
All right, so here you are behind your computer typing away your books. All of a sudden, now the characters spring to life on the screen.
Yeah.
Not really as you envisioned them, I guess. What's that like for you?
It's a little strange. I stick to my book version. I mean, in my mind, their characters are the way I originally envisioned them. The difference is a little disconcerting to some readers and TV viewers, but, you know, I think that people can pop back and forth between the two. It doesn't change my writing, but what I, you know, people always ask, well, aren't you bothered that they've changed a few things? My reaction to it is, look, I wrote the original melody. They're doing the jazz version. It's okay. they have made it much more glamorous. They've made it a lot more funny. The executive producer, Janet Tamaro, who's in charge of the storylines, she's a really funny woman. And I like the fact that she has drawn this demarcation between the characters. She told me that she sees them as being Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock. Jane is Captain Kirk, you know, the impetuous, by the gut kind of a cop, and Maura Isles is Mr. Spock, who is scientific and logical. And I think that sort of contrast between the characters is a classic one.
I guess I don't know how that would be if I were writing a book and I had in my mind's eye who my characters were than saw them on television. It seems like it might be hard for me to differentiate them. For you, I guess.
No, I think I can draw that line. And since I don't work on the TV show, they have their own team of writers. I can work in my own little sphere.
All right, with the television show, have they used any of your other characters?
Yes, a lot of the characters have been transferred into the TV series. Detective Corsack, who in the books is retired, is actively on the Boston PD force in the TV show. Jane's mother, who has become quite important in the books, is certainly very important on the TV show. And the one I think was really well portrayed was my villain. Now, in the books, his name is Warren Hoyt. They had to change his name to Charles Hoyt because there is a real Warren Hoyt in Boston. And they didn't want to get in trouble because of that. So yeah, there are all these minor characters that have made it. Detective Barry Frost, who in the books is Jane's partner. He was a real radical change in when they cast him. In the books, he's described as pale and blonde, and he's played by an African-American actor on TV. But he retains that same innocence, that same character, for both TV and books. So it's fun to watch all these secondary characters make it into the show as well.
How have they advanced through the series? How have they aged?
Oh, they have evolved quite a bit. I started off with this, you know, Jane and Maura at one particular point in their lives. Jane is single, bitter, an outsider, and Maura is kind of a standoffish. You don't know who she is. She's a mystery. And as the book has gone on, Jane has fallen in love. She's gotten married. She's become happier. And because of that level of happiness, she's become a lot less bitter. So you do see her grow and mature as she becomes a mom. Maura Isles, we get to know her quite a bit more and find out she's extremely complicated. And she has a reason to be dark. She's an adopted child, and she discovers who her parents really were, and it's a horrifying discovery for her. Much more horrifying than on the television show. Jane's mother is a serial killer and in prison. Maura's mother is a serial killer in prison. And she has to face that, you know, that essential, who am I question? And why did I choose such a dark profession? Is it because I come from, you know, sort of monstrous roots? So you also see the friendship develop quite gradually. They don't start off being friends in the books. They are just colleagues. And through time, as with real friendships, you learn to trust each other, and you learn that this other person is the best at what she does. I'm going to turn to her. And when they do become friends, it's a little bit of an uneasy friendship that has its ups and downs.
Yeah, I guess just like any friendship, I mean, how do friendships come about? And that must be fun. It must have been fun to write Rizzoli and Isles becoming friends in your series.
Yeah, very, very slowly and very gradually, and I think very organically. That you wouldn't expect these two women to be friends in real life because they're so different. But because they're thrown together in case after case and they've learned to trust each other, it has become quite a powerful friendship.
You were writing books before Rizzoli and Isles, so how many books? I mean, you've got about, 10 books in the series here. How many overall?
Oh, overall, I've done, well, if you count my romantic suspense novels, which I wrote early on in my career, I've got 24 books.
Now, the romance, pretty quick to write, I guess, as opposed to these?
Well, you know, every book is difficult. The genres are, I can't think there's an easy genre if you want to write good books. But I wrote 9 of those before I moved on to medical thrillers. And in my career, I've done medical thrillers, I've done an historical, I've done science fiction, and I've done crime. So I mean, the only thing I haven't done is a Western, I guess, and a fantasy. I haven't done one of those yet.
Was a Western in the forecast?
No immediate plans on that. But you know, I just feel that I need to write the story that inspires me, and whatever the genre is, that's the genre I'll write in.
All right. So, what genre right now is hot? I mean, it used to be the vampires. And I don't know if they're quite as hot as they used to be.
I think right now hot is essentially erotic fiction. I mean, 50 Shades of Grey has changed the look of the bestseller list. When you look at the tops in paperbacks, it's if it's not 50 Shades, it's a book similar to that.
How does that come about? I mean, it would be tough to sell. I mean, unless you're right in the mainstream, and if you're outside, it seems like, from what I hear, books are hard to sell anyway, but those would even be harder. How did, 50 Shades become a hit? Do you have any idea?
That's a good question. I'm sure that people in New York are scratching their heads over it. You know, and it's funny how books suddenly hit the top of the list and then stay there for years. I can't explain the Celestine Prophecy any more than anyone else can. And I can't really explain 50 Shades because, you know, erotic romances have been written for decades. There have been many, many very good authors in the romantic, in the romance genre who've written good books. But they didn't get this success until 50 Shades came out. And now they're being rediscovered. So, a certain time, a certain place, a certain point in readers' tastes, and all of a sudden it's hot.
Tess, now, what was your favorite genre that you've written about? Is it the crime? Is it the romance? What is it?
You know, people always ask, what are your favorite books? And I point to 2 books of my books in particular. One of them was a book called The Bone Garden, which was historical. It was about an outbreak of childbed fever in the 1830s, but there's also a murder mystery in it, and it stars a real historical figure called Oliver Wendell Holmes, a doctor. He was a medical student at the time this story is set. I loved that book, but it didn't sell well. And then the other book, which was my favorite, was a book called Gravity, a biological disaster aboard the International Space Station. Came out in 1999, got great reviews, sold movie rights. That book did not sell well. So it's funny, you ask authors, what are your favorite books? It tends to be the ones that they worked the hardest on, that were the most challenging, but they are not always the most successful books.
Although now, do you read, crime fiction as you're writing? I mean, it seems like some people do, some people don't.
Yeah, I think I tend to focus a lot on nonfiction because I love acquiring information. I'm very curious, and if there's a good nonfiction book about a subject I'm interested in, I'll grab it.
All right, Last to Die, your brand new book, Rizzoli and Isles. What's next? What are you working on right now?
I'm working on number 11 in the series, and it's inspired by something that happened to me in South Africa last year on safari. I was surrounded by dangerous animals, and yes, it is dangerous out there in the bush. Lions and you know, hippos and rhinoceroses. And I remembered thinking the only person who's keeping me safe right now is the ranger, the guide. Who has a gun, but what if he's not who he says he is? And, you know, they're surrounded by danger, and then looking at this one person I'm supposed to trust, I got that shiver up my spine when I thought, okay, this is the next book. Something about, you know, the one person who's supposed to keep you safe is actually there to kill you.
No, Rizzoli and Isles, they seem to always be surrounded by dangerous animals.
yeah, of the humankind.
All right, now, Tess, if I want to find out more about Last to Die, more about Rizzoli and Isles, more about your other books, I'm sure you have a website out there.
I do. It's tessgerritsen.com. The problem is my last name is hard to spell, and it's a G-E-R-R-I-T-S-E-N.
All right, so when we go to the website, what are we going to experience?
Oh, you'll find stuff about the books. You'll find a blog. You'll find a little store where I sell Rizzoli and Isles swag, and all the profits go directly to Reading is Fundamental. You'll find more biographical information about me.
Probably find out where you might be next.
Yes, you will definitely find that out.
All right. So, well, you know, I don't know if I ask. Maybe you mentioned this, but who are some of your favorite authors out there? I mean, you do like to read a lot.
I do like to read a lot. I'm gonna mention Val McDermott, great author, you know, good English mysteries. I'm very, very fond of Douglas Preston because he does science, you know, and he makes science really fascinating, even though he sometimes goes over the top, but it's fun. And you know, who can not love Stephen King? A man who's now become, I think, a symbol of our man of letters, even though for years he toiled in what was considered genre fiction.
All right, well, if you want a good read, Last to Die, Rizzoli and Isles, I tell you what, the first three chapters we visit, or three or four chapters, we visit three families, and, oh, the horrors that happen in this book will just keep you turning the page just to find out what happens to Last to Die. Tess, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Hey, you know, Last to Die, Rizzoli and Isles, what a fantastic series. There's only 10 in the series. Start from number one, and don't forget about the hit series on TNT. You've been listening to Cover to Cover. I've been your host, Mark DeWitt, along with Tess Gerritsen, author of Last to Die. To access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.